This teaching comes to you from the team at St. Mark's, Darling Point, Sydney. We hope that it blesses you.
Good morning. The first reading comes from Judges, chapter 9, firstly verse 1 to 25 and then 46 to 57. Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal, went to his mother's brothers in Shechem and said to them and to all his mother's clan, "Ask all the citizens of Shechem, which is better for you, to have all 70 of Jerubbaal's sons rule over you, or just one man? Remember, I am your flesh and blood." When the brothers repeated all this to the citizens of Shechem, they were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, "He is related to us." They gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal-berith, and Abimelech used it to hire reckless scoundrels who became his followers. He went to his father's home in Ophrah, and on one stone murdered his 70 brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, escaped by hiding. Then all the citizens of Shechem and Beth Millo gathered beside the great tree at the pillar in Shechem to crown Abimelech king. When Jotham was told about this, he climbed up on the top of Mount Gerizim and shouted to them, "Listen to me, citizens of Shechem, so that God may listen to you. One day the trees went out to anoint a king for themselves. They said to the olive tree, 'Be our king.' But the olive tree answered, 'Should I give up my oil, by which both gods and humans are honored, to hold sway over the trees?' Next, the trees said to the fig tree, 'Come and be our king.' But the fig tree replied, 'Should I give up my fruit, so good and sweet, to hold sway over the trees?' Then the tree said to the vine, 'Come and be our king.' But the vine answered, 'Should I give up my wine, which cheers both gods and humans, to hold sway over the trees?' Finally, all the trees said to the thorn bush, 'Come and be our king.' The thorn bush said to the trees, 'If you really want to anoint me king over you, come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, then let fire come out of the thorn bush and consume the cedars of Lebanon. Have you acted honorably and in good faith by making Abimelech king? Have you been fair to Jerubbaal and his family? Have you treated him as he deserves? Remember that my father fought for you and risked his life to rescue you from the hand of Midian. But today you have revolted against my father's family. You have murdered his 70 sons on a single stone and have made Abimelech, the son of his female slave, king over the citizens of Shechem, because he is related to you. So have you acted honorably and in good faith towards Jerubbaal and his family today? If you have, may Abimelech be your joy, and may you be his too. But if you have not, let fire come out from Abimelech and consume you, the citizens of Shechem and Beth Millo. And let fire come out from you, the citizens of Shechem and Beth Millo, and consume Abimelech.' Then Jotham fled, escaping to Beer, and he lived there because he was afraid of his brother Abimelech. After Abimelech had governed Israel for 3 years, God stirred up animosity between Abimelech and the citizens of Shechem, so that they acted treacherously against Abimelech. God did this in order that the crime against Jerubbaal's 70 sons, the shedding of their blood, might be avenged on their brother Abimelech and on the citizens of Shechem who had helped him murder his brothers. In opposition to him, these citizens of Shechem set men on the hilltops to ambush and rob everyone who passed by, and this was reported to Abimelech." Now from verse 46. On hearing this, the citizens in the tower of Shechem went into the stronghold of the temple of El-Berith. When Abimelech heard that they had assembled there, he and all his men went up Mount Zalmon. He took an axe and cut off some branches, which he lifted to his shoulders. He ordered the men with him, "Quick, do what you have seen me do." So all the men cut branches and followed Abimelech. They piled them against the stronghold and set it on fire with the people still inside. So all the people in the tower of Shechem, about 1,000 men and women, also died. Next, Abimelech went to Thebez and besieged it and captured it. Inside the city, however, was a strong tower, to which all the men and women, all the people of the city, had fled. They had locked themselves in and climbed up on the tower roof. Abimelech went to the tower and attacked it. But as he approached the entrance to the tower to set it on fire, a woman dropped an upper millstone on his head and cracked his skull. Hurriedly, he called to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and kill me, so that they can't say a woman killed him." So his servant ran him through, and he died. When the Israelites saw that Abimelech was dead, they went home. Thus, God repaid the wickedness that Abimelech had done to his father by murdering his 70 brothers. God also made the people of Shechem pay for all their wickedness. The curse of Jotham, son of Jerubbaal, came on them. This is the word of the Lord.
The second reading you'll be pleased is not that long. The second reading comes from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 20, verses 25 to 28. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Our series on the book of Judges. Thank you, Audrey, for taking on and reading so well. Last week we met Gideon, who's got another name, and his other name appears in this passage. His other name is Jerubbaal or Gideon, and he's a reluctant hero, remember, the anxious believer, the man who asked for a sign not once but twice. And yet it was through his faltering faith and fragile courage that God revealed his might. Gideon is the patron, not quite saint, of spiritual imposters everywhere. Those of us who wonder whether God could really use someone like us. And it's not surprising that many of us identified with Gideon last week. And yet it was precisely through Gideon's weakness and his doubt in God and his self-doubt, his trembling obedience, that God's strength shone the brightest. We follow a crucified Lord. The cross is not just God's plan B, it's his very method of triumph. His strength is made perfect, not in self-sufficiency, but in surrender. The most powerful prayer a Christian can pray isn't, "I've got this, God, but I can't. Help me. I can't. Help me." God does not help those who help themselves. He helps those who know they can't help themselves. But today's story flips the script for us, because for today we meet Abimelech, who is Gideon's or Jerubbaal's son. If Gideon was the man who didn't believe he was enough, Abimelech is the man who thinks he is more than enough, everything. Where Gideon is hesitant, Abimelech seizes the day and is ruthless. Where Gideon stumbles into leadership by grace, Abimelech seizes it by force. He's an Iron Age Macbeth, following the self-destructive path of vaulting ambition, of charisma without character, of power without prayer. And as we'll see, it ends in disaster. It's a complete shambles. Now, this is not a comfortable story. It's a warning. It's a dark parable about the kind of leadership that rises when God is pushed aside. It's about the kind of culture that follows a man who makes himself the king. It's a story of betrayal, of political theatre, of violence and of judgment. And yet, as disturbing and strange as it is, it's also painfully familiar. You could be thinking that we're no longer reading the Bible but scrolling the headlines. Judges chapter 9 isn't ancient history, it's a mirror. And so the question it asks is not just how could this happen, it's not just a historical curiosity, but where is this happening now? And deeper still, where might it be happening among and in us? So let's listen to this story and ask what it reveals, not just about our world out there, it's easy to point fingers, isn't it? But about the temptations that we have in here, in our hearts, in our institutions, in our ambitions. Because the gospel of Jesus Christ doesn't just comfort the weak, it confronts the strong. Well, how did the story of Gideon end? Not very well. Though he began as a humble, trembling man who trusted the Lord, success changed him. After his stunning military victory with just 300 men armed with trumpets, nothing more savage than trumpets and lights, the people of Israel offered to make him a king. And he gave the right answer. He refused, saying, No, the Lord is the one who rules over you. You have the Lord as your king. But then his actions told a different story. Firstly, from the spoils of war, Gideon made a golden ephod, which is a richly ornamented priestly garment, priestly vestments, but made out of gold. And he set it up in his hometown. It was meant perhaps to honor God. It was meant as a memorial to what God had done, but it dazzled the people so much that they began to worship it. What was intended as a symbol of faith became a snare. The Bible uses that word snare, a snare for the people and a snare, a trap for Gideon. The shrine itself became an idol. And then we're told, almost in passing, that he had 70 sons. Now, how does a man acquire 70 sons? Not from one exhausted wife, but from many wives and concubines. And of course, if he had 70 sons, we can only imagine that he had an equal number of daughters. Gideon may have been denied the crown, he may have denied the crown, but he started to live like royalty anyway, like a pagan warlord, like a tribal chieftain, like a minor sultan with a harem, or a would-be Genghis Khan. One of these sons, a son born of one of his slave girls, was a man called Abimelech. And that's a very strange name. It's a name that gives away the game. For this name means, my father is king. It's like being called prince. So much for Gideon's refusal. He may have turned down the throne in public, but it seems that he's feeling a bit ambivalent about it. He's already acting like a king and naming his children like a dynasty that's about to begin. And so when Gideon, Jerubbaal, dies, that dynasty is what Abimelech sets out to secure. He returns to his mother's city, Shechem, where his relatives have influence. Israel, by that time, had once again spiraled into forgetfulness, worshipping the Baals, forgetting the Lord, as they always seem to do time and time again in this tragic book, the book of Judges. And this is Abimelech's opportunity. He seizes the moment. He goes to his mother's clan with a proposal. He says, look, would you rather be ruled by 70 men? I mean, that sounds like parliament, doesn't it? Who wants to be ruled by a plurality of people? It just sounds chaotic and indecisive. All the sons of Gideon, or by just one man, your flesh and blood, let me represent your interests. It's a chilling echo of modern politics. Appeal to blood and soil. Cast yourself as the strong man who protect the local identity. Make the promise to protect. And it works. Then as now, it works. The clan hands over 70 shekels of silver, which have been taken from the temple of Baal. So it's kind of attached to the worship of this false god. And Abimelech, what does he do with the money? Well, he does what would-be tyrants do world over. He hires a gang of thugs, of mercenaries. He gets his private army of brown shirts together so he can do his bidding. And with that private army, he rounds up his 70 brothers. And what does he do? Executes them in cold blood on one single stone. It's a chilling moment. a single brutal purge of all other contenders to the throne. Actually, the sultans of the Ottoman Empire, whose fathers used to, the sultans used to have large harems and have many sons, and this is exactly what each successive sultan had to do, is murder all these brothers so there's no contenders to the throne. This is what we see Abimelech do. It's a pattern that's not unknown in human history. It's really just straight out of Hitler, Mao and Stalin's playbook, isn't it? It's a day of the long knives, or the long knife in this case. The rise of Abimelech is swift, violent and calculated. And it leaves us with a disturbing question. How do we get here? How did Israel get to this point? Well, this is what happens when spiritual amnesia takes hold. Israel has forgotten the power of the grace of God. They've forgotten the God who called them out of Egypt. The Lord, gracious and compassionate, abounding in steadfast love. They forgot that grace that calls for their dependence on Him. That's how they had got into the land, and they had clearly forgotten it. When they trust in God, He rescues them from all their foes. They already have an extraordinary, merciful King and Almighty God. What more do they need? Well, instead, they've grasped at the convenient fix of political muscle. Instead of the reluctant Gideon chosen by God, they've chosen Abimelech, who has appointed himself a king. And the result is a bloodbath, isn't it? Because when the God of grace is forgotten, power rushes in to fill the gap. Power just fills up that space when we forget God. And when power itself becomes God, blood becomes its liturgy. In every age, there are Abimelechs. Leaders who claim divine authority or something like that, manifest destiny, but act in defiance of God, the true God. Kings crowned not by justice or by calling, but by convenience, coercion and cowardice. And yet into the deep darkness of this moment of raw political violence, God has got something to say, for one brother has escaped. One brother, Jotham, failed to be killed on that stone, and he's got a parable for the people who want to make Abimelech king. He goes and stands on a mount. Now, the word mount is perhaps too grand. It's really just a hill, and it's a hill overlooking the town. So you can imagine him standing there. He's at a safe distance because the crowd has gathered to make Abimelech king. But Jotham's got a story to tell. He's got this parable. And the parable goes something like this. Once upon a time, the trees gathered to make a king for themselves, and they go first to the olive tree, then to the fig tree, then to the vine tree. Each one fruitful, each one life-giving and good. But each of them refuses to rule. Each of them says, I'm doing something else at the moment. I don't want to be king. I'm too busy producing what the world needs. But instead of trying to persuade one of the trees turn to the thorn bush, a useless, dry and prickly plant that offers no fruit and no real shelter. The thorn bush readily accepts the crown, but warns, take refuge in my shade, such as it is, or be burned by my fire. Jotham's message is as sharp as a sword. You have made a thornbush your king. You've crowned ambition, not righteousness. You've enthroned violence. You've put on the throne someone who's out only for their own power and interest. So don't be surprised when you get burned. Why do we choose thorn bushes so often? Not just in government, but in business, in educational institutions, and in churches as well. Why do we celebrate the ruthless CEO? The unhinged tech bro billionaire, or the charismatic pastor with expensive sneakers and gold teeth? One Christian organization I know chose the workplace bully as its leader. His behavior was well known to those who chose him. Why did they choose him? He would be a strong defender of the truth. He might be a bully, but he's our bully. It's persuasive rhetoric, isn't it? Why do we fall for it again and again? Because we're afraid and hungry. We're afraid of being unled. We're afraid of being overrun. We're hungry for someone, for anyone to take charge, to give us direction, to make us feel safe or important or seen. Like the people of Shechem, we often prefer a strong voice over a wise one. We mistake loudness for confidence, arrogance for vision, and aggression for strength. Thornbush leaders, what are they like? They speak in absolutes, don't they? They give us black and white answers to grey and painful questions. They offer strength when we feel weak, identity when we feel lost, creativity when we're stuck for ideas, and clarity when the world feels chaotic. But we are always better off when we choose for fruitful character, even when we choose a reluctant leader over the most ambitious one. In fact, the person who too readily wants to be the leader, too readily wants to be in charge, that's a red flag. The person we have to persuade is often the one we really need. Now, what happens next is as terrible as it is predictable. Abimelech and the citizens of Shechem, who were allies in evildoing, turn on one another. And this is what makes this chapter stand out in the book of Judges. Not only is Abimelech not a judge, he's never called a judge here. The judges were raised up by God to save Israel from outside enemies who had enslaved them, from foreign invaders. Instead, what we have here is a self-appointed king who causes a civil war with devastating results. And this war goes on and reaches its climax with the siege and destruction of the very city that had put Abimelech in power in the first place. It's Shechem. There's a siege of Shechem and the city is finally destroyed. And then all the people rush into the temple of Baal, into the tower, that God that they had turned to instead of the true God, and take refuge there. And what does Abimelech do? Ruthlessly, he and his men set the tower on fire so that about 1,000 people die in the flames. It's an infamous crime, but it's a sad fulfillment of Jotham's prophetic warning. Unleash the demon and you'll find yourself in hell. Choose the thorn bush and see if you won't get burned. Flee to Baal and he won't protect you. But just when Abimelech thinks he's untouchable, he's burned, pursued scorched earth over Shechem, when he heads off to repeat this policy at another tower, his story comes to an ironic and humiliating end. In fact, a comic end. We're right to laugh at the ridiculousness of it. For Abimelech falls into a ridiculous end. It undoes his pretensions, doesn't it? A woman, we don't know her name, just drops a millstone from the top of the tower. Doink! And he's done for. It crushes his skull. It's a bit of a repeat of the story a few weeks ago where Jael and Sisera, you might remember Jael, nails a tent peg through Sisera's head. In Abimelech's final moment, desperate to protect his male ego, he begs his armor bearer to finish him off so no one could say that he was killed by a woman. Perish the thought. But the Bible does say it, and we still say it. Because the legacy of this would-be big man is not greatness, it's disgrace. He killed his brothers on a stone. Now he's been struck down by a stone. The truth falls on him like a rock upon his skull. Thus, the chapter concludes, lest we be in any doubt as to who has been in charge of all of this. God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech and brought back on the heads of Shechem all the evil they had done. It's a reminder of the lesson of Gideon. Though it may look quiet and hidden, God's justice is powerfully at work. In God's way of doing things, force meets its end not by greater force, but by the unassuming hand of the insignificant and anonymous. The hand that crushes the tyrant is that of one outside of the arena of power. Thus is justice done. Not in strength, but in weakness. God allows evil to turn on itself As the Midianites turn on one another in the darkness in the story of Gideon, and as Shechem and Abimelech pursued their path of mutually assured what? Destruction. Mad. So who should we crown? If Gideon gives us a glimpse, however flawed, of the deliverer God would one day send, then Abimelech shows us the opposite. He's a parody of kingship, a warning in human form. Abimelech is the embodiment of injustice and unrighteous ambition. He doesn't just forget God, he defies him. And because everyone else has forgotten God, he's able to get away with it. In his thirst for power, he kills his brothers. He manipulates, he destroys, and in the end, he himself is destroyed. Contrast him with the true king, with Jesus Christ. Abimelech kills to rise, but Jesus dies to reign. Abimelech exalts himself, but Jesus did not consider equality with God as something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, humbled himself, taking the form of a servant, and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Abimelech sheds others' blood to take power. His path to power is littered with the corpses of his brothers. Jesus sheds his own blood for his brothers and sisters to set us free. The thorn bush promises shade but brings fire. But Jesus is the vine, the fruitful vine, offering shelter, fruit, and life. His gentleness is his strength. His meekness is his majesty. And so the question presses in for us, who shall we crown? Who do we give our allegiance to? What kind of king do we seek? What kind of power do we honour? Where do we seek for protection? Where do we seek for security, safety, and for the fulfilment of all our dreams and needs? Will we continue to give our loyalty to thorn bushes, to loud, controlling, destructive powers that scorch the things they touch? We must have the courage to say no to Abimelech's. One of the sad patterns of human history is the way in which people knew that they were appointing or anointing an abusive leader or king, can be in a very small setting as well as in a national one, and went with it anyway, or didn't know how to say no. We must say no to Abimelech's. We must not continue to crown them, even though we are so tempted to go with them because we are afraid and because we might not think we have obvious alternatives. But we follow the one whose power is made perfect in weakness, whose love restores, whose truth sets free, whose cross redeems. We want to be those who have his heart and to follow those who have his heart. Let it be so.
Thanks for listening. Please visit our website at www.stmarksdp.org to subscribe to our new episodes, browse more resources, and find more information about the community of St. Mark's.